Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is brought to you live on Friday morning, May 21st, 2010. It is now 7:01 a.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good morning, everyone. This morning, we're going to have Andy Sutton from Sutton Associates, and he'll be talking about the financial chaos that is going on right now, and what we've been experiencing now for some time. Andy is the chief investment strategist for Sutton Associates, which is an investment advisor in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. You know, I do promote his website and his services every time we broadcast, because I really believe in what he does, and he takes somebody like me that doesn't understand much and makes me understand things. And I think he'll do a world of good for you too. And I believe that's him on the line now. Let's see if we can connect with him and start the show. Good morning, Andy. Is that you?
Hi, Joe. How you doing?
Fine, Andy. Thank you so much for being on our show this morning, especially on such short notice. I certainly do appreciate that.
Oh, no problem. Hey, it's good to be back.
Well, I guess we picked a pretty good time anyway, because the markets don't seem to be very docile in the past few days. They seem to be quite moving in the wrong direction, has people, procrastinators, giving us all sorts of projections as to what may or may not happen. And so, of course, this is what I think we're going to talk about a little bit today. But before we start off, Andy, what I'd like to, I have a question, that something that really bothers me, and I'm afraid if I do not ask this up front, now I will forget to ask. Do you mind if I just ask you a question right up front in the beginning?
No, go right ahead.
It's no secret that the dollar is losing its luster as the world's reserve currency. More and more people are becoming more and more skeptical to fiat currency, what the dollar is worth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet banks are giving 30-year loans at 4.68%. Now, to me, that makes absolutely no sense. People are concerned about hyperinflation, possibly. They're concerned about the total debasement of the dollar altogether, or maybe the collapse of the dollar. And here we have banks giving 30-year commitments at 4.68% when we know inflation is somewhere around 2, 3, 4%, whatever, however you want to calculate it. Could you please enlighten me on that?
Well, Joe, it's pretty simple. You have a situation where the banks are in a no-loss position, really, when you think about it. I mean, just go back to 2008. They took huge risks. They created derivative pools that were several dozen times in excess of the available money supply. I mean, we were talking at one point over $1,250 trillion. I mean, that's just an unfathomable amount of money that these guys had in notional value of derivatives. So they went out there and they participated and created all these excesses, really at the behest of Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke, and they did this. And when it goes kaboom, then they just fall back on the American taxpayer and say, we need a bailout. If you don't bail us out, there's going to be a depression, the markets are going to collapse, and everything's going to get really bad, and Congress runs right in and gives them a bailout. And it's like a dog and pony show, Joe. So they have no downside risk when you think about it.
Oh, so
they're going to be made whole. Yeah, they're going to be made whole. So they don't have, what does it matter to them if they're in at 4.68 on the 30-year mortgage when, any reasonable amount of inflation that you're considering and you actually calculate it correctly is at least 5, 6, 7%, depending on where you happen to be.
Right. Oh, I see. So they give away the money. If they lose money, they get the money back from the government, from me and you, actually, anyway. So it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. And they make their money in other places as well, especially credit cards and whatever, which is the interest rates there are pretty high. And I feel sorry for the people who have these large, large balances who have now been reset at 28% or 29%. I don't know how they're going to do it. I guess it's all part of that impoverishing of America that's really been going on for about 30 years, slowly but surely. This erosion of wealth that we've seen that's been sucked out of the American family. And the American family really has played along with this. They really bought into this whole thing of this is what I can have, and all I have to do is get a second mortgage. All I have to do is refinance. All I have to do is sell my annuities, you know, on and on and on and on, to the point where people no longer have, in my opinion, the wealth that they tried to accumulate back in the 1950s. When I remember when people owned a home, they bought a $17,000 house, and that was a lot of money back then, but they had to put $3,000 or $4,000 down. They had some savings. They had no credit cards to speak of, obviously, during that period of time. And if they owned a car, they owned the car. If they had a note, it was only a 2-year note, but they had to put some money down. There was some wealth accumulation together with some of the debt. Today, this is that's non-existent, it seems.
Well, and you have to remember also, most of the banks that underwrite mortgages, Joe, they also do credit cards. And you've heard of a loss leader in marketing.
Right.
And what that is, basically, for the listeners, is, you know, sometimes a store will just give stuff away below margin and to get people in the store and get them to buy other stuff. Well, I think the banks, in a lot of ways, do the same thing. Right. You know, if you're Bank of America, and I'm going to pick on them because they do a lot of mortgages now. You know, they've absorbed Countrywide and what have you. If you're Bank of America, you do credit cards and you do mortgages. So what they might do is they might offer, you know, Joe Schmo a mortgage at 4.68% and get them in the door, and then they can get them a credit card, but the credit card's maybe at 19.9.
Right.
You know, so they can, and they know he paid too much for the house. They know what his financial situation is because hopefully they at least did some due diligence, but they know he's going to use the credit card, and they know that the odds are very good that he's going to run a balance, and they're going to make a lot of money on the credit card side of it. So like you said, the banks play in more than one ring. You know, they do mortgages, they do credit cards, they do car loans, they do all kind of stuff. And then you got the investment side, which really kind of, you had a separation there for a lot of years from the Glass-Steagall Act, which kept the commercial banking and investment banking sides apart. But now they're in bed together, and, you know, they do all the derivative stuff and credit default swaps and investments on the other side. So, yeah, they play in a lot of areas. And, you know, the mortgages could very well, in many cases, be a loss leader, that they just want to get people in. But, again, it comes back to the fact that there's no downside for these guys.
Right.
They lose, they run to the taxpayer, they run to Congress. If they win, they get to keep all the money. It's like heads we win, tails you lose.
Well, you know, it reminds me, one day I was wondering that, you know, I saw the sign outside of a Walmart that said, you know, our gasoline is 3 cents cheaper if you use a Walmart card or a debit card with Walmart name on it. And I said, well, geez, how could they do that? I mean, there's very little margin, you know, in gasoline to start off with, and their gasoline is on the low end on the price scale. And then I thought, I said, well, geez, that 3 cents represents, let's say, about 1%. People put it on their Walmart card, and most likely these people are revolving, which means they're collecting somewhere between 12% and 30% interest. And I go, so they give up 1% at the pump so they can collect 12% or 16% on the other end. I go,
yeah,
smart
absolutely.
Move.
Yeah.
I had to answer my own question.
Well, the thing is, though, you know people are going to fall for this stuff too, because we've got a society now, and it's, you know, this has been another marketing strategy, and it's really occurred over 30, 40 years. You know, and like you pointed out, back in the 50s, people didn't have this mentality. They had the, you know, if you want something, well, you save your money until you have enough money, and then you go and buy it.
Right.
You know, now everybody has to have everything immediately. You know, I was just reading an article here the other day. You know, graduations are coming up now for college and high schools and whatever, and you've got all these new entrants to the workforce. You're going to have all these new entrants to the workforce. And the article kind of alluded to the fact that 2009 graduates are waiting tables. But if you take a look at these kids, every one of them has the latest in gadgets. They all have a new car. You see very few kids driving around an old junky car like I used to drive when I was 17, 18, 19. You know, it's just, it's that kind of a mentality now. We have to have it, and we have to have it now.
Right.
And that's that's not just a human nature kind of thing, because we were savers. We were frugal. And we've been rolled over by years of clever marketing.
Well, you know, the government says, well, people aren't spending, they're saving their money, and they allude to the fact that this is bad for the economy. Isn't that good for the economy? Because when we save money, that money is invested, and then those investments in industry and whatever create jobs, which provide what the consumer wants at the lowest possible price, and doesn't that and creates jobs in the long run. Is that not true, or am I thinking funny?
Well, see, the problem is when you have a manufacturing and export-based economy, the saving and investment is very important.
Right.
You need money to build factories, so you've got to have savings in the pool to provide capital for these investments, you know, that people are going to make in factories, businesses, infrastructure, those types of things.
Right.
But when you roll over and you do a crossover to a service-based economy, it's service and consumption, which is what we have now. Savings is a bad thing. You need people, you need money velocity. You need people to be out spending money and buying these services, because a lot of these services you can't export. You know, can't export a barber visit,
right.
A visit to the barber or a hairdresser or, the nail salon. You know, those services can't be exported. They're consumed here domestically. So, when you get into that kind of an economy where 70% of your activity is based on consumption by the consumers, the savings model is no good. It's like an Occam's razor. People need to save money because they need to get out of debt.
Right.
I'm not really convinced, Joe, that there's a heck of a lot of savings going on. I mean, you can go down to the Apple store here on a Saturday afternoon and watch people burn through $5,000 like it's nothing.
Right. Well, I heard, and now this I heard on television, and I very rarely watch TV, but yesterday I was stuck at home folding laundry, so I decided to put on Fox News. And one of the gals said, I forgot what I was going to say. My mind is slipping on me. There are the people who have money are really spending it and spending it big time. That's why spending is as high as it is. And that didn't make any sense to me. I mean, because why would they be spending any differently today than they would have a year or 2 years or 3 years ago? And the people who, the big mass of people who were spending, who are now not spending, why wouldn't that overtake the amount or the additional amount that the people with money are spending? That didn't make any sense. Our spending keeps on a pretty good high track. I mean, it hasn't really decreased that much, has it?
No. I mean, retail sales have been, they were flat for a while, but now they've been going up. But I mean, I tend to tear these reports apart, as you know, and dissect them. And there's a lot of one-off factors that have played into a lot of these reports. People are not spending as vigorously in the aggregate as they were a year or two ago or three. And what the Fox News person, I mean, there actually may be a modicum of truth to that, because, you know, if you have somebody that's very well-to-do and every time they go out to the store, they see sales on this and sales on that.
Right.
You know, retailers have been cutting prices, to try to move inventory and that sort of thing. So, that may, pull more spending from the future
That's
into the
true.
Present.
Right.
There may be enough inducement there to get people to spend more money. But you're right. You have such a large, I don't want to say underclass, but, middle underclass, whatever you
right.
want to call it, of people that are suffering from unemployment. They already have too much debt. Consumer credit is not generally more available than it was. It's less available and at a higher cost. That's been well documented. So you've got this basically a drag on consumer spending. Are 5 or 10% of the population going to be able to make up for that in the long run? I don't believe so. You're going to run into a point here, and you're already seeing it, where people are tapped out. If there's no more ATM, for a long time the house was the ATM. Well, that's pretty much stopped now.
Right.
You're going to get into a situation where people just aren't going to be able to sustain the spending. And that 5 or 10% that is very well-to-do, they're going to have a harder and harder time carrying the rest of us in terms of making the overall numbers continue to go up. So, I mean, these are some of the fundamental problems for a service and consumption-based economy.
Yeah. Well,
what we need to do is if people are inclined to save money now, what we need to do is roll that over and transform our economy back to manufacturing and exports.
Right.
But we don't want to do that because it's better to bring in junk from China, I guess. You know, we have all kind of problems with that.
Well, you know, I have a new pastime, and that is every time I go shopping with my wife, I walk around the shopping center and I count the number of what I call holes, the number of stores that are closed or places that are available for rent. And I wish I would have done this
you
for years.
Too, huh?
Well, because, you know, it would be very interesting. I'm certain they weren't that many closed a couple of years ago as there are today. Sometimes, in fact, I went to a coffee shop once on my motorcycle, and as I backed my motorcycle, I backed it up, I noticed on both sides of the coffee shop, both shops were, you know, they were vacant. And then I looked on the other side of those two, they were vacant, and there were six shops in a row, except for the coffee shop, that were vacant, a very large shopping center. And I said, boy, this is really, it just hit me hard when I saw that. And I guess that, and
yeah,
Tulsa's not in that bad a shape, I mean, compared to the rest of the nation.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've been seeing that around here, too. There's a lot more vacancies in shopping malls, and we've seen an increase here in the number of homes that are just sitting vacant. We've got one right up the street from us. They tried to sell it at a tax auction, and for whatever reason they couldn't move it. So it's just sitting there. It's in limbo. It's not foreclosed. It's not anything. It's just, I don't even know who owns it.
Yeah.
You know, there seems to be a lot of that going on in some of the larger areas, you know, like the housing areas like California, Arizona, Michigan, Florida, places like that. That seems to be on the rise as well. So you've got this, you know, again, it's a drag. It's an undertow on overall activity, and I think that a lot of folks, you know, in the mainstream media and the mainstream economists, they don't put enough weight on the fundamentals and the structural imbalances that we have. We've got a broken credit system. It's been broken for 3 years now. I talked about this in 2007 already, and people said you're crazy. And I actually had one mainstream economist tell me that I needed to be admitted to a psychological ward for saying that the credit function was broken. And I think he's the one that needs to be admitted because that turned out to be exactly the case. You know, that's been going on for a while now. And as long as that remains broken, when you have an economy that's dependent on credit and spending, it's just not going to, it's just going to bottom bounce.
Yeah.
There's no way for it to improve.
Yeah. Just let me take a break for a second, Andy. This is Liberty Talk Radio.
Sure.
I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. And with us this morning, we have Andy Sutton of Sutton Associates. He's a chief strategist for Sutton Associates. And they are a registered investment advisor in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Andy has a newsletter, both a free newsletter on mytwocentsonline.com and also Sutton Associates, sutton-associates.net, I believe it is, where you have a paid subscription, and in that gives you good investment advice. If you're like me and you manage your own portfolio, I do recommend that you take a look at that, because he takes very complex issues, puts them in terms that even I understand. And if I understand them, folks, I guarantee you understand them. He is taking calls, and we do have two callers right now. Let us take a call right now. And by the way, our caller number is 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Let's take the next caller. Caller, you're on the air. Hello? Oh, we lost him. All right, let's try the next one. Caller, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joe, Andy. This is Jim calling from Bixby.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
How you doing, Jim?
Great. Always enjoy your commentary. And Andy, just a question for you. I want to put you on the spot. In light of the market conditions, what's developed the last couple of weeks, as a nervous investor, I'm concerned about all of the quantitative easing of the central bankers around the world, and my strategy has been leaning towards the natural resources and precious metals as my safe haven in this crazy world. But they seem, as you know, in a market collapse, those investments tend to drop as much or even more severe than blue chips or other investments. So my question is twofold. One, how do you see things unfold in the coming weeks and months with the economy and the stock market? And two, will there ever be a time where metals and mining and natural resources, those investments, will decouple, if you will, from the rest of the market and be recognized for their true value?
Jim, those are good questions. I'll take the second one first, actually, because this is something I wrote about a few weeks ago. We had seen, I guess this was last week and the week before, the markets, the paper markets, were starting to drop off, and gold and silver, they had been hit a little bit, but they had bounced back. Gold actually made new highs. They were holding up well. The gold index, the HUI, was holding up extremely well. But what we're seeing now is the momentum is starting to pick up on the downside. And invariably what happens is anything that's paper is going to get sold off, because this is really a wholesale liquidation like what we saw back in 2008, where you have people are nervous, some people are losing out on some things. I'm talking big banks and hedge funds and investment companies and that sort of thing. They start to lose out, and they get margin calls, and they have to get liquid. And I think that's one of the things that actually triggered the mini crash that we had on May 6th. Gold had been up $30 intraday before the crash happened, and it's basically my thesis at this point that somebody got into trouble, had to get liquid and hit the panic button. But basically, you had seen oil had raced up since the lows at the end of 2008. It had more than doubled. And so there's a lot of profits in there right now. There were a lot of profits in gold, profits in silver, profits in the CRB index, those types of things, grains, softs, what have you. And those are going to get sold first. And when there's a liquidation, they're going to get sold hard. So you get really enhanced volatility in those areas just because they had been profitable. And if you take a look back to 2008, it was the same thing at the beginning was the case with the banks.
Right.
A lot of the bank stocks had done really well, and they were the first things that got sold. So I think that really is what is going on here. And this is one of those situations where you have to separate the fundamentals from what goes on in paper markets. Has what has happened over the past 3 weeks changed aggregate demand for food? Well, no, it hasn't. The demand function of food has not changed in 3 weeks based on what has happened in the paper markets.
Sure.
So you're getting spurious action here. At the same time, I'm not going to sit here and say, that's not going to hurt people. It is and it can, and it is likely to continue to hurt people who are staying in those markets. So I think this is our new normal, if you will, going forward. You're going to see more and more volatile swings in markets, and this has really been the case over the past couple of years now. So one of the strategies that people will take is, all right, if these things race up, then it looks like things are starting to roll over. You might have to exit a theme for a while and just wait till all the noise happens, the liquidation occurs, things start to calm down. And it kind of goes against the grain of a fundamental investor. A fundamental investor picks a theme, they select their entry position, they buy, they hold, they collect dividends, what have you. It kind of goes against the fundamental investor. The second thing you can really do there, if you want to stay in, especially if you have stocks that pay good dividends, is you can try to hedge, and that's one of the things that we handle in the newsletter. We put some hedges in place a few months ago, and we looked bad for about a month, but now we're starting to look pretty good on those things. And basically, it's protection. It's a bit of an insurance policy, and it allows us in many cases to keep collecting dividends, while all of this nonsense plays out, and not have things get hit too hard. Now, I'll be honest with you, in a perfect world, that would work perfectly, but obviously we don't live in a perfect world. So, it's one of those things. You've got to be on top of the wheel, so
right,
to speak,
right,
on the economy, your investments, what you're doing, and just keeping an eye on your strategy. It's, the world has changed, Jim. We can't just, select something and walk away for 5 years. We can't do that anymore. We got to be on top of it. Maybe not daily, but at the very least, you got to be checking in on a weekly basis and looking at things and just, keeping your finger on the pulse of what's going on.
Absolutely. Good advice. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, and any thoughts as to the craziness of You know, I know that what we hear in news and mainstream is just so much noise and distraction, and I'm not so sure that there isn't, you know, manipulation in the market. I have a lot of a lot of skepticism about things, but all that said, do you think we're going to see a repeat of the collapse of 08, and how do things look for the rest of 2010 here with our economy and the market?
Well, basically, you've got a tug of war going on right now. There's a lot of folks on one side saying you've got the prop desks, you've got the plunge team, quantitative easing, the push towards hyperinflation, and that is going to win the day, and you're going to see, you know, this is just a head fake, and you're going to see these markets go higher and make new highs on a nominal basis. And then there's another camp saying, hey, we've got a global situation, 20 countries now at least, at a minimum, including this one, the UK, most of Western Europe, and there's a few others that are fundamentally bankrupt. They're fundamentally insolvent right now. We took a look at this a few weeks ago in a commentary and laid it out. We have bills that we can't pay. We've made promises we can't pay for. This is not just an American phenomenon. This is most of the G7, a good portion of the G20. We have lived on this unfunded liabilities Ponzi scheme, whatever you want to call it, now with regards to social insurance programs, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, Part A, B, C, D, E, F, H, whatever. We've done all these things. We've made these promises, and we can't deliver on them. There's no way to pay for them. And at least in this country, we are, I would think, at the point now, we can't print enough money to do it. And this is why I've kind of said, you know, I don't think we're going to go into hyperinflation anymore. I think we're going to see a default. And that's deflationary. And we have seen, you know, backing this up, M3 growth is now negative. It was upwards of 20% just a year and a half ago, and it's dropped off totally. It's now at around -4%, -5% M3 growth. So M3 is starting to contract. That's the broadest measure of money here in the United States. And there is a very distinct correlation between M3 growth and economic activity. So as long as that is proceeding, it would appear at least that you know, this whole idea of quantitative easing is not making it in the broad money measures. You're seeing contraction and you know, that sort of thing going on. So I tend to lean towards the side of, you know, I don't know that we necessarily go back 100% to the way it was in the Great Depression, but I think we'll get a flavor of that just because of the fact that, you know, bankers knew about quantitative easing back then. You know, everybody acts like they didn't know that they needed to print more money. Well, that's baloney. We had been experimenting with national banks and overprinting fiat currencies in the United States for years and years and years, really since before the country was even founded. We knew about money printing. Yeah. You know, this idea that the bankers back then, well, they just didn't know they needed to print more money. And Mr. Bernanke is so smart. Mr. Bernanke is just pointing out what everybody's known for the last 250 years.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not buying that, and I think that's what we're going back to. I think that was how they reset the system, if you will, back in the 1930s, and I think they're going to try and do the same thing again. Like I said, maybe not the same flavor, but you might see a devaluation of some sorts first to get rid of a lot of these debts, the external debts, the unfunded liabilities, tantamount with cuts of programs and those types of things, and then basically slamming the door on monetary growth. That's kind of the way I'm seeing it right now, just based on some of these realities we got going on.
Well, thank you. That's good advice. And just want to let you know, I always enjoy your commentary and analysis. I turn to you and the folks at the Stansberry Group and try to cut out all the other noise for good sound advice. So glad you're back on the program with Joe again. And again, thanks for your answers. Have a good day.
No problem.
Jim, thank
you
for calling in.
All right, take care.
What is this? How does this bode for precious metals in the event that we have a contraction? And let's assume that the recession accelerates, and now we're into terminology, recession, depression, whatever, and things get worse. It looks like we're heading for a depression. Wouldn't that trigger the Federal Reserve to start printing money might quickly, or would they just let it slide down? And then what would happen to people who have invested in commodities at that point?
Well, I mean, you've got a situation, John. This is one of the reasons why I've always said you needed to get on early in the commodities game, especially gold and silver. In a deflationary type situation, what would happen there is obviously the nominal, dollar paper dollar price of those metals could go down, but you're not going to have as many dollars in the system. So,
right.
You know, you're not going to be able to support higher commodity prices, higher gold prices, higher silver prices. But the nice thing about having those things, you could see them emerge as monetary substitutes. You know, they're actually real money, but
right.
I'm talking about substituting for paper currencies. People could start using junk silver to do, like little co-op type transactions instead of using paper money, because those coins are available in large quantities. People have them in large quantities, and they could be used. You know, you could see silver eagles become something of a medium of exchange.
Right.
You could even see gold become something of a medium of exchange in that type of environment. People, a lot of times, I think, look at gold and silver as only guards against hyperinflation and against wanton money creation and that sort of thing. I think in a situation where you have a deflation, you would be more likely to actually use the coins than to look to trade them in for dollars. You know, I think a lot of times people get caught in this little dollar jail, so to speak. They only think of things in terms of paper dollars, and you have to think of things in terms of purchasing power. You know, what will a gold coin buy you? What will a silver coin buy you?
Right.
You know, if you go back to the 1960s, before we stopped making silver coins, Joe, you could take two silver dollars and fill the family car with gasoline. You can take two silver dollars today, silver eagles, and fill the family car with gasoline. So
right.
That has not lost any value. It's
right.
Maintained its value. People think they're going to get rich off precious metals, and that's just not the way it works. You protect your purchasing power, and that's one of the things that I scream whenever I have the opportunity to do so, because I think so often, you know, you hear these commercials on TV and the radio and everybody's talking about gold's up 20% every year. Well, the dollar's down 20% every year. You start looking in terms of, trade prices, import prices, prices for things here. Look at what's happened to college educations over the years and those types of things. You know, the dollar's losing value very quickly. And, you know, this nonsense about, oh, the dollar index is going up, that must mean the dollar is getting stronger. That's just total rubbish
right.
as well.
I heard that yesterday. Somebody with my, again, when I was folding laundry, you know, I'm such a good husband, you know. In fact, I am a good husband because I do the ironing. My wife will never leave me, I'll be honest with you. Otherwise, I think I'm a lost cause. But I was watching the television. This financial guy said, well, now that the dollar has, you know, has gained in strength, and he went on, you know, with his premise on, you know, based on the dollar gaining strength. And I thought to myself, you know, why didn't one of these jerks on whatever channel I was watching just scream and say, the dollar didn't gain any strength, the euro lost value, so on a relative basis, it looked better. You know, it's like saying, the doctor says, I'm in terrible physical shape, aerobically, anaerobically, every way, I'm falling apart. And I say, well, you know, now I'm feeling much better because I passed by a gym and I picked up an application, you know, but it doesn't make any sense. I'm not in any better shape. I'm in worse shape because I haven't done anything, but I passed by the gym. And this is what this guy was saying. And no one challenges them. And I think the average person watching this repeats that stuff and then believes it. It becomes a religion to them. And I hear this all the time.
Well,
and I don't argue
yeah.
with these people because you can't. I mean, they think you're un-American, you're a communist if you talk about, you know, the dollar not being as strong as they would love to believe that it is.
Well, this is all a creation, really, of marketing and the mainstream press. They will never challenge that notion because, you know, as Hank Paulson used to robotically say, a strong dollar is in the national interest. That was his answer for everything. And it was very robotic. It was almost like the guy was hypnotized. I mean, I really, you know, if you watched him in hearings and news conferences and whatever, I mean, he would just, like, mechanically reproduce this.
Right.
And that's the way people are in this country. And, you know, you've got to understand how the dollar index is calculated. You've got the euro at 57.8% of the weight of that index. So it's highly weighted. And what you have is they take the value of the pair. And when the euro goes down, the dollar goes up. When the dollar goes down, the euro goes up. That's
right.
how it works.
Right.
Because they're pairs. So we don't have dollar strength. We have euro weakness.
Right.
Now, from an export perspective or buying European imports, you know, this certainly does affect things because, you know, our dollar now buys more in Europe than it would have otherwise because that's basically a function of how the pair works.
Right.
So there are some real manifestations and some real effects that you can see from this phenomenon. But coming out and saying that now we have a strong dollar, that's ridiculous.
Right.
I know, if you went back to last week before this liquidation really got some legs, gold was actually going up with the dollar index.
Right.
So you had the gold market saying, okay, you know, yeah, the strong dollar, yeah, this is how strong we think it is. Ratchet gold up another $30 an ounce. Gold is the real currency. And we've seen for a long time, you know, there's a lot of people that have exposed this. There's, you know, a concerted effort by bankers to hammer down the price of gold because high gold prices really destroy this mythology of strong fiat paper currency.
Right.
And that's been going on for years and years and years, and they've been losing this battle. You know, 10 years ago, gold was at $250 an ounce. You know, now it's at, you know, $1,185 or whatever it is right now. So they've been losing this battle slowly. They can't keep winning the battle because there's a lot of people, even some central banks, that are starting to realize this is probably going to be the way of the future because these fiat currencies are in a state of meltdown, and it's not just the dollar. It's not just the euro. We're going to have the same problems, Joe, here that they're having in Europe right now because of the same problems. You have little Greece with their 13% of GDP annual budget deficit, and they're going to take down the euro. And it's not just because it's little Greece. It's little Greece and little Spain and little Portugal and little Ireland and little Italy. All of these countries are in trouble, and we are in trouble the same way they're in trouble. And we'll be the last to fall because we have the reserve currency. But it's a paper currency. It's fraudulent. It's phony. And it's going to be exposed, and it is being exposed. And that's what's going to happen. The UK, throw them in there too, because they've got the exact same problems we do. This is systemic.
Right. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll get back, because I have some questions about the Euroland. Folks, you're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We're pleased to have with us Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist for Sutton Associates, a registered investment advisor in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And Andy is an expert. If you read his commentary and his newsletters on my2centsonline.com, or you can go to andy-associates.net and pick it up there. He also has a paid subscription, and he has one that's absolutely free of charge. I don't know how you do it, Andy, but every time I read, and you can ask my wife this, I make this comment every time because I print them out and I take them to the coffee shop on my motorcycle, and I read every one of yours. I say, damn, he's smart. I wonder where he gets all the stuff, how he knows all this stuff. You know, I feel the only thing I don't like about your newsletter is I feel so stupid afterwards because I don't know this stuff. But you do such a good job of it, and you make you format it in a way that I understand, and it gives me a foundation from which that I can look at my investments and protect myself. And that's what I really like about it. It gives me a better understanding of what's happening in the world, and so I know where to go. Sometimes I don't know exactly what to do, but I know where I want to go, and that I appreciate. And folks, I do recommend that you look at his newsletter, read a couple of them, and do subscribe to his paid subscription. It'd be the best thing you ever did, especially if you have investments like I do. Now, Andy, I have primarily all commodities, and so I'm looking at Europe, and I'm looking at Europe, you know, getting really shaky. I know that does not bode well for us. So I'm sort of like, hey, I may make some money on this deal. Am I delusionary?
Well, again, you have to get back, and this is kind of what I said to Jim. You've got to be able to separate the fundamentals from market noise, market volatility. Has the situation with the demand for, corn, has that changed in the past 3 weeks? The answer would be no. Have corn prices been hit because of the liquidation that's been going on? Yeah, they haven't been hit as hard as everything else just because of the fact that the profits weren't there from the last bottom. That's what you have to watch. When you see this is a function, Joe, of our whole new world. And you're actually, I don't want to say too much because I'm going to be writing about this in next month's newsletter. But this is kind of like, I hate to use the term the new normal because I hate to steal anything from the mainstream press, but this is kind of like the system reset that we've gotten to since 2000. You've got these big moves, and they're more volatile, and they're more frequent. You know, the crises are becoming compacted. You know, they're more and more often, and we're having liquidations. You know, this is now really the beginning of the second one since 2008. Now we had 2008, now we're having 2010. But there were a lot of profits from the last bottom in stocks. There were a lot of profits in commodities, things like that. Those are areas that are going to get hit. The areas that have the biggest gains are going to be the ones that get sold first when you get into the liquidation. So as a commodity investor, you have a couple of choices. You can strategically exit positions and sit on the sidelines in cash, and a lot of people have done that. Some people put in, you know, maybe they don't use, you know, stop orders per se, but they have psychological stops. They say, you know, if, you know, stock X gets below $20 a share, I'm out. I'm going to wait. I'm going to sit on the sidelines, and I'm going to let the craziness take place. And when it looks like the craziness has settled down, then I'll jump back in and try to ride the next wave up. And a lot of people are very loath to do that because that's kind of akin to market timing. And it's hard to use the term market timer and the term fundamental investor in the same sentence. They generally don't. They're pretty much. I don't know how you would even call it. They're polar opposites. And what you've got there is a situation where you can do that, or you can say, all right, I'm going to try and employ some type of a hedge and stay in the market and do these types of things. But I think as people understand that these markets are prone to volatility, I think you're going to see more and more people try to capture the middle two quartiles of the moves and sit on the outside at the margins. And I think that's a strategy that you're going to see start to take place, even with fundamental investors, because people don't want to get caught up in this stuff.
Well, you know, I know
it's becoming more frequent.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
I spoke to many people about this, and they say, well, you know, I'd love to sell my commodities, but I feel we'll always need them for long term. I'm in better shape, and I hate taking my commodities and converting them to U.S. dollars because I don't trust it. So there's this uneasiness to get out of commodities, although commodities may be going down on the short term. You know, they say, well, I'm not going to cash out now. You know, the long term, I'll be better off. And I've never been able to time the market properly. Whenever I got out and got in, I always seemed to lose in the transaction. So I stay where I am and I'll wait it out. Now, that's what I have done because I never know when to do, when to get out, and then when to get back in again. So I sit there, and sometimes I've gotten hammered so incredibly hard. I mean, when we had the big downturn a couple of years ago where people lost 40% of their investment, I lost 60%, if not more. I mean, it was like everything flying out the window. I almost jumped out of the basement window and sprained my ankle. Yeah, I mean, that's how bad it was. So, it was horrible. But most of this, I mean, it came back, but I can see this happening again. And I'm sitting here saying, well, I'm going to go through this trauma and all over again. But there's something about holding commodities that gives you this warm, fuzzy feeling, even as the price goes down.
Well, I'm going to ask you this, and I'm not trying to be a wise guy. When you say holding commodities, you're not talking about a garage full of bushels of corn, wheat, barley.
EFTs in wheat, you know, soybean, you know, stuff like that, uranium, copper, all that stuff, you know.
This is where I think you have to adjust your thinking a little bit on this. If you're holding the physical commodity, like say your gold and silver, if you're one of those people that actually holds physical metal, and I think that's a good thing, by the way.
Yeah, I have some of that too.
That's something you're holding in your hand, and it's fungible, and you can use it.
Right.
The problem with a lot of the other commodities is we don't actually have the physical commodity. We have paper, and as such, you know, people always say, well, you know, commodities are going to be good because they're always going to be necessary. Yeah, the commodity itself is always going to be necessary, but what about the paper? And this is where I think there's a disconnect in thinking. People kind of get into this trap where they figure, well, I bought, you know, this principal protected note, or I bought an ETF, or I bought a stock in some company that is part of this, you know, commodity procurement, production, whatever process.
Right.
So I have you have exposure to that market, but the problem is, at the end of the day, it's all paper.
Right.
And as such, you know, if we do see this situation play out like we had back in the 30s, where, you know, the banking authorities, and mind you, there are banking authorities. You know, we've got global banking authorities, and none of them are sovereign, by the way. They're all global, including our Federal Reserve. They might decide to try to reset the system much in the same way they did back in the 1930s. If they do that, this paper is going to get crushed.
Okay.
The demand for the commodities themselves will not change, but the paper can be crushed.
Okay.
And that is where I think you have to put your thinking on this kind of situation here.
Okay. I really have to change my thinking a little bit. I do. You know, I forgot to mention that our call-in number, excuse me, Andy, is 646-652-4620. Let us hear from you. Don't worry about interrupting us. We want to hear your call. Get your call. 646-652-4620. You can send us email anytime to comments at libertytalkradio.com. All right, now, Andy, what's going to happen to Euroland?
Euroland?
Yeah.
Well, you've got a situation where you've got a few small economies now are placing huge burdens on the rest of the system, particularly Germany. Germans, by their nature, are frugal people. They're savers. And Germany has some of the better fundamentals in the Euroland, although they're certainly nowhere near perfect. They are quasi-normal. You're having all of these other areas that are placing more and more pressure on Germany. Germany is already starting to balk. Merkel was out the other day talking about how this $1 trillion, as a rescue fund for the smallest portion of the Eurozone economy. That alone should be a signal that this problem is too big to fail, and at the same time, it is too big to save. The Germans cannot carry this burden.
Right.
It will not happen. The European Central Bank has two choices at this point. One is to try to perpetuate this system through endless monetary creation and destroy the currency, and that's going to happen very quickly. It's not going to take decades. It'll take months or years. Or they can move towards a situation where there's some sort of a reorganization / default, something along those lines. You could see as an alternate the Eurozone start kicking countries out. That may happen. But you're already seeing rioting in a lot of these places, you know, obviously Greece. Germans are protesting, and what I would watch out for is a lot of these more responsible countries, the people aren't going to tolerate this. And you saw what the Icelanders did to their situation that they had with all this debt to the international banking cartel. They said, pound sand.
Right.
Take a long walk off the ship here. We're not paying.
And justifiably
and
so.
The Greeks are moving
right.
towards that.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I really think we're keeping our eye off the ball. You know, people ask me, because when I talk about investments when I'm with other people and whatever, when I have that opportunity, because I enjoy talking about that, and then they ask me for advice or something like that. And I say, well, you know, I gave up my license to be God some time ago. I wasn't very good at it, so I can't tell you what to do because I have no idea what's going to happen. I said, there's only one piece of advice I can give you. I give this to everyone. I can guarantee you, no matter what happens, it'll be something that you never, ever expected. And that's exactly what happens. Whenever we keep our eye on Iceland, something goes on in Greece. I mean, something always goes on somewhere. You know, we're concentrating on one area, all of a sudden the Gulf has oil in it, you know, and it's spouting all over the place. It's going to ruin the economy, it may ruin the economy of the entire southeast part of the United States. But so, I mean, we never know what's going to happen. There's too many things going on, millions of things going on at one time, and any one of them could explode. That being said, we're looking at Europe, and we say Europe, we mean Western Europe, but we're not talking about Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe is becoming a basket case in and of itself, and there's Western Europe who has investments in Eastern Europe which are no longer any good. I mean,
sure.
We're taking our eye, when I say off the ball, we're taking our eye off the whole macroeconomic situation. We're just focusing on one area. Am I looking at that wrong or correctly?
No, you're not. That's why I said earlier, the problem is paper currencies, and the problem is paper. And this is what is, it's systemic. You know, like I said before, this is what is going on everywhere. It's not just Greece. You know, these are the kind of the pus bubbles, if you will, that are coming up here and there, the little boiling spots, the little minor volcanic eruptions that are happening on the macrosphere here. But the whole problem is underneath. The whole problem is the foundation. The foundation is flawed. The understanding of how an economy works is flawed, because for many years we've had this Keynesian philosophy that, you know, when the economy swings into a business cycle, and by the way, we didn't have these wicked business cycles when we didn't have paper currencies. They didn't happen.
Right.
And that's kind of an odd phenomenon. You know, the problem is the paper. And the solution has always been, well, when there's a wild swing in the business cycle, you just print more money, you spend money you don't have, and somehow it all gets better. Well, the problem is this is cumulative.
Right.
And, you know, back we got away with it in the 40s, 50s, and the early part of the 60s because we had massive gold reserves, because we had many years of prosperity. We built a nice manufacturing infrastructure. We were exporters. We weren't decimated by World War I and World War II. So we were in a superior position, and instead of taking advantage of that, we squandered it on
right.
social programs.
Unfortunately.
And the Great Society and Lyndon Johnson and his whole mantra of, you know, chicken in every mouth and the ocean's turning lemonade, as Fourier likes to say. And that cost us our gold. That cost us our position. It cost us our reserves. And once that was gone, we started climbing the hill of debt accumulation, deficit
right.
spending, and just general indebtedness across all the levels. Jerry, you've got like almost 40 states are broke. This is everywhere. Townships are broke. They're laying off workers, police, firemen, teachers, government workers, all over the place, all over the country. It's not epicentered in California, Michigan, Arizona, and Florida, as people would like you to believe. This is going on everywhere. The problem is paper money. That
right.
is the ball that we need yeah. to be keeping our eyes on at this point. All these other things that go on are a function of broken paper money economics.
Right.
And that's the bottom line, at least in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, how
I know people will argue with that, and they'll say, well, you know, Keynesianism is good. We've had such good times because of Keynesianism. Well, you know, as I forget who the person was at the IMF said, the party's over. And they're not speaking of it because from a common sense perspective. They're saying that the international banking cartel is no longer going to support
right.
These global social programs. And things are going to change here,
yeah.
and they're going to change quickly. And this is something that people need to start preparing for now.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was having coffee with a fellow friend of mine who's an anesthesiologist. And he said, you know, I said, well, you know, where do you have all your money? You know, and he goes, well, I have it here, there. And he says, I have a big portion of it in, you know, municipal bonds. And I said, Charlie, municipal bonds? I said, the municipalities are bankrupt. And he stood there and he looked at me. He didn't argue. He looked at me and he got frightened. And he said, you're right. And he almost ran home. I think he sold them or something. I mean, I just said that to him. Well, that's where you put your money. They're bankrupt. I mean, they're broke, you know. And it just stopped him and made him think. And he's, you're right. I thought that was kind of funny. Well, how come we don't hear anything about Eastern Europe? We only hear Western Europe. Is there any reason for that? We used to hear a lot about Eastern Europe at one time.
Well, you know, everybody kind of forgets Eastern Europe a little bit. You know, you've got
yep.
Latvia and a bunch of other countries over there that are really the Ukraine. A lot of these countries in
you've
Eastern
got Poland,
Europe are
you know,
dire Romania. Straits. Yeah, they're in similar shape to Greece and the rest of them and us, and it's all for the same reasons. Paper money again.
Yeah.
The same scoundrel in this case as well. But you know, they're not as romantic, you know, as saying Greece or Italy. You know, they don't have this, developed world visage to them or whatever. So they kind of get ignored. But you know, don't forget that there's a lot of problems there too. Africa has a lot of problems. Australia, I don't know if you saw, they just put a huge, huge mining and procurement tax on some of their companies over there. You know, that's kind of gotten the ball rolling there. You're going to see that elsewhere.
Yeah.
That's going to hit the mining sector. So you've got all these black swans. You know, you've got a flock of black swans that are out there, and they're all starting to kind of hit us from different directions. And it is becoming increasingly difficult to navigate this. You know, you've got the cap and trade situation here that they want to try to enforce here in the United States now. That's going to change things before we even have figured out all the damage that this health care bill is going to do. We have no idea the damage that that health care bill is going to do.
Right.
And before we even assess that, we're just moving right on to the next thing here. And this government, I think this government, got a good deal down in Mexico on some illicit drugs or something, because they're acting like a bunch of crazy people right now.
You know, when Medicare first came out, I believe I saw a figure. They said they estimated it to be $3 billion a year, and now it's $300 billion. They were a little off, you know? I mean, the government is usually not off by just 5 or 10%. It's usually off in multiples, I mean, exponentially off, and always in the wrong direction. And I don't know why we ever believe any of these figures. If they say this is going to cost $100 billion, you know it's going to be closer to $1 trillion. I mean, it's immediately.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, what about how is China doing? Have you been keeping your pulse on China or in India?
Yeah, China is in a situation right now. Their latest GDP numbers were 12% annualized growth in that ballpark. That's not sustainable. Their market, the Shanghai Index, has crashed around 25% since last August. It's forming a massive head and shoulders top for you technical people that are out there. Check that out. They're in for some potential problems.
Yeah.
12% is, everybody says, wow, that's fantastic. It's great, but it's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. They're overheated. They've been doing a lot of the same kind of things that we've been doing here with stimulus and all of these types of things. The only difference there is they have the resources to do it, whereas we don't. But I think they're in a situation where they've actually overstimulated, and they're going to have to come back down. Now, they did a couple years ago. They're up around 10-11% on the GDP side, and then they got down to 5 or 6, and then they went back up again. Hey, if they could stay at 5 or 6, boy, I tell you what, if you're going to calculate honest numbers here in America, we'll never see 5 or 6% again.
Yeah.
Now, take out all the government spending from borrowed money, we'll never see 5 or 6% again until this whole thing gets reworked somehow. And we need to return to, our old ways, back in the turn of the last century here, 1800s through 1900s. We had the right idea then. We're on the wrong track now.
It'd be very difficult for people to do that, to think that they can do without or save money and then buy something and all that other stuff. The things that we used to do back in the old days, or, ride around in a 53 Buick, that was right on the side, things like that. It never ceases to amaze me. I see people with, very minimal means, driving around in a $54,000 pickup truck. It just absolutely throws me wild. Back when I was young, someone of that person's needs, would be in a clunker, not the cash one. We would be taking those cash for clunker cars. No, they would be too good, quite frankly. They would, anyway. Well, Andy, it's almost time. We have about 1 or 2 more minutes. Would you like to give us a little wrap up and maybe tell us a little bit about your program that you have going there, and so our listeners would know who you are and where to find you?
Well, thank you. Basically, what we do is there's two approaches that I use. One is the paid newsletter, which you so kindly talked about. And basically what we do there is we get a lot more detail about a lot of stuff we talked about. I do a lot of research and present these themes in greater detail, and then try to give you actionable information as far as the economy goes, what's likely to happen in the economy, and those types of things. And it's really geared towards self-directed investors. People that manage their own money can take that resource, and they can use it to help them to form opinions about where they need to go with their own investments. We do handle managed accounts as well. And really what I do is I advocate a highly diversified approach. I don't advise people to put all of their money in stocks, certainly. I'd be a hypocrite and a liar if I did that. I advocate strong positions in precious metals, physical precious metals, different types of commodity exposures, those types of things. And getting out of debt. I have people all the time ask me about investing money, and the first thing I always ask is, are you in debt? And if they say yes, I say, good, come back to me when you're not in debt. Get out of debt first. I know that sacrifices income on my part, but I really think it's the right thing to do, the right advice to give people. And basically, in short, I think people need to be aware of volatility, and you need to be very selective of the themes that you select for your investments, and where you're going to go. And I think if you want to stick around in some of these areas, you know, you need to look at ways to kind of hedge your positions a little
Andy,
bit so you don't, get a hit.
We're going to lose a phone in about 2 seconds. So let me thank you very much for being on our program. Oh, we lost
you. Hey, thank you, Jar. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Andy. Bye-bye now.
All right, bye now.
Wow, that was a power-packed hour. This is the end of today's program, but we'd like to thank Grant Shakers Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you are either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there's no middle ground. Folks, freedom is like riding a motorcycle. You feel free, liberated. Your life is in your own hands, but with that freedom comes responsibility and risk. The government is like training wheels. They control the ride and your every move. Ron Paul has a sign on his desk that says, "Don't steal, the government hates competition." With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.